no doubt you are aware that your beliefs affect your biological makeup, but the question remains, just how much do they affect it? In this volume, Dr. Chopra examines the power of your beliefs and how they ultimately affect the way that you think, feel, and behave. There are many factors that contribute to your belief system. It is created by your personal experiences, environment, and upbringing in conjunction with the collective belief system of the society that you live in. Changing your biological makeup, for example, reversing the aging process, is possible. Dr. Chopra clarifies how taking care of your physical body is only half of the formula, and how having soulful, intimate relationships, daily routine, and a sense of living for the world beyond the self all contribute to a life full of meaning and longevity.
The way people age is a result of both individual and cultural influences. There are whole societies in which people share very different styles of conditioning from what we experience in the West, and therefore they share very different styles of aging as well. Growing older in Chicago can be totally unlike growing older in Lisbon, for example, just as Portuguese is totally unlike English. And in recent decades, anthropologists have been surprised to discover how many so-called primitive peoples are immune to signs of aging that we have long accepted, including some of the most common causes of death among elderly Americans. S. Boyd Eaton, co-author of a fascinating book about early man's health titled The Paleolithic Prescription, refers to at least 25 traditional societies around the world where heart disease and cancer, two of the conditions frequently associated with aging, are almost unknown. For us in the West, these societies represent a priceless resource for learning more about the aging process. They are our best testing ground for the hypothesis that normal aging is really a collection of symptoms born from abnormal conditioning, that growing old is really learned behavior. For example, the members of indigenous cultures in many widely separated areas, Venezuela, the Solomon Islands, Tasmania, and the African desert, all enjoy low blood pressure throughout their lives. This is completely contrary to the trend in the United States and Western Europe, where almost everyone's blood pressure rises by a few points every decade, and up to half of the aged population tends to be hypertensive. Why do the members of one culture experience life so differently from another? Why is a medical condition that's virtually taken for granted in America all but unheard of in other parts of the world? Beyond the obvious variations in diet and overall lifestyles, there are less tangible reasons as well. Social bonds, for instance, can be invisible but very powerful factors. These are complex phenomena covering all the interactions of language, customs, family structure, and social tradition that bind people together. The net result is that awareness of one sort or another gets programmed. Social bonding takes place at the level of mind. This means much more than simply eating the same amount of fish or meat as the other members of the culture. It means perceiving that another person is like you and believing that he or she sees you the same way. You share in a larger self, an interconnected psyche that is as sensitive and intricate as an individual mind. This is enormously significant. Hundreds of books have been written about the aging process on the assumption that growing old is something that inevitably happens to people as a result of unavoidable physical processes. Now, however, we are seeing that aging is something that we've learned, something that social conditioning taught our bodies to do. It's hard to think of a more crucial distinction. Because if aging is something that's happening to you, then basically you're a helpless victim, just as much as if you'd been caught in an earthquake. But if aging is something you learned, you retain the power of choice. You're in a position to unlearn the behavior that's making you age, to abandon old beliefs and adopt new ones, and to be guided into new opportunities. Belief creates biology. That's an aphorism made famous by the late Norman Cousins, and no truer statement was ever made about aging. Our inherited expectation that the body must wear out over time, coupled with deep beliefs that we are fated to suffer, grow old and die, creates the biological phenomenon we call growing old. Yes, belief creates biology, but life is awareness in action, which means that despite the thousands of hours of old messages that we've internalized and that have come together to program our responses, we continue to live because awareness finds new ways to flow. And the positive side of awareness, its ability to heal, is always there and always available, no matter what date is on your birth certificate. The complexity of the forces operating inside an aging body becomes obvious when you ask a seemingly easy question. How old are you? Before you reply, let me point out that for the purposes of our program, there are three distinct and separate ways to measure someone's age. The first is chronological age, or how old you are by the calendar. The second measurement is biological age, or how old your body is in terms of critical life signs and cellular processes. And finally, there is psychological age, which refers to how old you feel you are. Only the first of these is fixed, yet your chronological age is also the most unreliable of the three. You can find proof of this just by thinking of people you know. There may be someone who's 50 years old, who's nearly as healthy as when he or she was at 25, while another may already have had the body of someone 10 or even 20 years older. To really begin to judge how old you are, the second measure, biological age, must be brought into play. Biological age tells us how time has affected your organs and tissues compared to other people of your chronological age. Even within your own body, the effect of time isn't uniform. Practically every cell, tissue, and organ is aging on its own timetable, which makes biological age much more complex than chronological age. It's even possible to have several biological ages. A middle-aged marathon runner may have the leg muscles, heart, and lungs of someone half his age, but his knees and kidneys may be aging rapidly due to excessive stress. And his eyesight and hearing could be declining on their own idiosyncratic paths. And all these variations become more pronounced as you grow older. So your uniqueness compared to other people increases as the years pass. To get a clearer idea of how this works, consider the fact that at age 20, when muscle development, reflexes, sexual drive, and many other primary functions are reaching their peak, most people look alike to a physiologist. Young hearts, brains, kidneys, and lungs all exhibit healthy color and firmness. In a 20-year body, evidence of malformed disease or dying tissue is scanty or non-existent. But time will change all that. By age 70, no two bodies are even remotely alike. At that age, your body will be like no one else's in the world. Its age changes will reflect everything that's happened to you, not only what you've done, but what you've thought and felt also. Biological age also indicates its limits as a measurement tool. Considered purely as biology, the aging process moves at such a slow rate that its fatal effects rarely match those of faster-moving diseases. Most critical organs can function well at 30% of peak capacity. So if our bodies are losing 1% of their functioning per year after age 30, it would take 70 years or a chronological age of 100 before aging per se threatens a particular organ with imminent breakdown. But social and psychological influences are always at work. Our lifestyles subject us to various conditions, and the differences in how we age show up much earlier in life. Two stroke patients in their mid-50s with identical medical conditions can, and often do, display wildly different outcomes. One may recover from the attack quickly, respond well to physical therapy, and easily regain lost speech and movement, ultimately returning to normal life. The other may respond poorly to treatment, be overcome with depression, and give up all active pursuits. In a short time, he may grow old and die. This is the result of something quite apart from chronological or even biological age. The determining factor is psychological age, which is also the most personal and mysterious of the three measurements, but also the one that holds the most promise for reversing the aging process. Biological age is known to be changeable. Regular physical exercise, for example, can reverse 10 of the most typical effects of biological age, including high blood pressure, excess body fat, improper sugar balance, and decreased muscle mass. Gerontologists have found that elderly people who agree to adopt better lifestyle habits improve their life expectancy on average by about 10 years. Thus, the arrow of time can move forward quickly or slowly, stop, or completely turn around. Your body becomes younger or older biologically, depending on how you treat it. Yet, your third age, psychological age, is even more flexible. Like biological age, psychological age is completely personal. No two people have exactly the same psychological age because no two people have had exactly the same experiences or have responded to their experiences in exactly the same way. By the way you choose to interpret and react to the events of your life, you can literally choose your psychological age no matter how old you are according to other measures. Listen to the thoughts of Anna Lundgren, age 101, who made a very important observation as a child that influenced how she aged for the next 80 or 90 years. "Back in Norway, when I was a little girl," Anna said, "when people got to be 55 or 65, they seemed to stop. From then on, they just sat there. That's old. I don't feel that old today." Your psychological age has no boundaries, and how old you feel can reverse itself in a split second. A middle-aged man who hears that his beloved wife has died can wither into lonely senescence in a matter of weeks. Yet an old woman recalling her first love can suddenly look and sound as if she had turned 18 again. Considering the vital influence of psychological age on your physiology, it is important to take advantage of the control you can have over your own psychological age. How old do you feel right now? If you're tired or you've had a stressful day at work, you may feel 10 years older than you did in the morning, and your body will manifest that feeling in its biology. On the other hand, by making the conscious choice to remain positive and upbeat despite everyday setbacks, in other words, by choosing a youthful psychological age, you can reap the benefits in your health and overall well-being. You can literally reverse your age just as quickly and easily as you can reset your watch. One of the best ways of tuning in is to sleep at the right time, to eat the right food at the right time, to exercise at the right time, and to listen to the messages of your body. Okay, how this relates to diet, we'll go into detail even further. I just want to say a few words about eating awareness, because I think even more than an understanding of how taste influences our physiology is the fact that if you pay a little attention to the act of eating, that if you employ the two
ways in which consciousness influences everything in our physiology, and those two components of consciousness, once again, are attention and intention. Attention being energy, and intention being information. Just bringing the act of eating into conscious awareness influences how it is metabolized. That's a very important fact to realize. So in most religions, and also in most spiritual traditions, the whole idea is that eating, in a way, is a holy act. Eating is the conversion of the life energy of the universe into the life energy of your body. Eating is the transformation of the cosmic body into the personal body. And therefore, it should be done with a little bit of attention and intention. And if you do that, it'll make a dramatic difference in the way you'll experience energy in your physiology. In the Eastern traditions, the most frequently practiced way of eating, the most frequent ritual associated with eating, is something called mindfulness meditation during eating, or mindful eating. And this is the way it's done. You sit down before your meal, and you look at the meal, and you acknowledge in your consciousness your gratitude for having the meal. And then before you pick it up, you notice its smell, you notice what it looks like, you notice what the taste might be, you anticipate that. And then as you pick it up, before you do that, you notice in your awareness the intention that you're going to pick it up. And then you put it in your mouth and you taste the food, you feel its texture, and before you do that, you notice in your awareness the fact that you are going to do that. And then you start chewing it, and before you start chewing it, you notice the intention to chew it. And then you swallow it, and before you swallow it, you notice in your awareness the intention to swallow it. And then you feel the sensation in the body or in the stomach in this area. And before you feel that, you notice that you're going to feel that. And simultaneously, you also feel the sensations in your body. So, obviously, you can't do this if you're watching television or listening to the radio or reading a book or a magazine or speaking with someone. This is literally a meditation. And if you do that, you will find that, first of all, your body will begin to respond in a very dramatic way and begin to tell you which foods are healthy for you, which foods are appropriate for you, and which foods the body really rejects. You can also do something else. When you look at the food, or even if you go to a restaurant and you look at a menu, you can look at the menu, and as you look at it, or as you look at the food, you can ask your stomach, you can put your attention in your stomach and ask your stomach, do you want this? And if it's healthy for you, the body will give you a little bit of a pull, a tugging feeling. You'll feel that. And if it's not, the body will give you a message that it doesn't want that. There'll be a recoiling sensation with that. You can try this with any food and you'll begin to see that your body is so intelligent and much smarter than your brain, and will give you the appropriate messages about whether a certain food is good for you or not, or even whether it really wants it or not. Many times, we put food or things in our body that our body doesn't want. For example, smoking. If you're a smoker and you want to really give up smoking, then the worst thing you can do is throw away your cigarettes and say, I'll never smoke again, because then the next time you have the urge, you'll have to drive 25 miles in the night, or you'll bum the next cigarette off the next person that you meet. What you really do is you keep the cigarettes with you, you go outside, you sit in fresh air, and before you start to smoke the cigarette, you take it out, and you put your hands over your lungs, and you ask the lungs, do you want this? And usually you'll get a response like this. You will. Try it. If you ask the body. And then if you still want to smoke the cigarette, then go ahead and smoke it, all the while feeling the sensations in your body. And asking your body, how do you like this? And you'll see that the body will start rejecting it. If you ask it, if you don't ask the body, then it just is like a garbage can. You can dump anything in there. Similarly, if you're used to drinking a lot of coffee, and you know that, by the way, coffee is okay to drink. A lot of people, when they see me at an airport drinking coffee, they come up to me and say, Dr. Chopra, you really drink coffee. So it's okay to drink coffee, particularly if you're a kapha body type. Okay? So kapha body types can do with a little coffee, whereas vata body types, even a sip of coffee will jar them. Kapha body types, a little bit of coffee will actually make them much more lively. And so if, for example, you're drinking a lot of coffee, and that's not good for anyone, when you look at the coffee, ask your body, do you want this? And usually, if, as I said, you're used to it, you like the taste, you like the aroma, your body responds to it, the first time you might feel a tug. But the second time, after your first cup, if you're going to have a second cup of coffee, you ask again the body, do you want this? And you'll find that the body really doesn't react. The third cup, you ask the body, and there's a recoiling sensation. The fourth cup, you ask the body, and your lower esophageal sphincter goes into spasm. And there's actually a painful experience there. And try it with any food. You'll begin to recognize that the body is really the ultimate and supreme genius. And it mirrors the wisdom of the universe. And so the more you begin to trust your body, the more you'll find that you'll spontaneously be choosing foods that are healthy for you, that are healthy for your body type. Okay, having said that, there are a few things that Ayurveda recommends. According to Ayurveda, the most important meal, usually, unless you're going out to a party or something, or celebrating, but usually, the most important meal is lunch. It's the time when the digestive fire is very lively. And therefore, lunch is the most important meal of the day. Breakfast and dinner are usually very light, according to Ayurveda. And you listen to your body always. You ask your body, how hungry are you? And get into that habit of listening to the body. You can even develop a scale if you want. The stomach is completely empty. If there's no remnant of food or fluid in the stomach, you can call that a 1. If the stomach is completely full and distended, you can call that a level 10. And if you always maintain the level of hunger between 1 and 5, 5 being your stomach seems satisfied and it's not distended, it feels good and you feel energy, then that's where you should be all the time, between a level 1 and a level 5. You should eat when your body says, I'm really hungry, which means there's no food, there's no remnant of food in your stomach. And you should always stop at about level 5. And level 5 means you're feeling energetic, you're feeling energized, you're feeling satisfied, but you're not feeling uncomfortable or distended. And if you maintain these levels, you occasionally practice eating meditation, you always sit down to eat, you don't carry on conversations while eating. You can carry out conversations while eating. You don't carry out conversations while you're chewing the food. And if you don't believe that people do that all the time, just go to any restaurant. You'll see all the mush in anybody's mouth. It's okay to speak when you eat, but speak only when the food is in your stomach, not when the food is in your mouth. And pick up the next bite of food when the previous bite has already gone into the stomach. These are very simple things, but most people don't pay attention to this. If you start paying attention to this, you'll start experiencing a new level of energy. You'll start experiencing that your body is choosing the right foods for you. You'll start noticing that your body is rejecting the foods that are unhealthy for you. At mealtimes, it's also recommended that you do not drink large amounts of water because that will dilute the digestive enzymes, the digestive fire, the digestive agni, as it's called. So you have only a few sips of water, and usually you don't have iced water or iced drinks because they also kill the digestive fires. So a few sips of water, room temperature, and not too much. You don't want to dilute the digestive fires. During the rest of the day, though, you drink large amounts of water. And again, not iced drinks. Iced drinks are not recommended for anyone because they kill the digestive fire, in a sense. They dilute the digestive fire. So room temperature or even warm or body temperature. If you're trying to lose weight, however, then you might want to fill up a thermos with boiling hot water in the morning, and then every half an hour you take a few sips of that hot water. This does two things. One, your body has to utilize energy to bring the hot water to your temperature. So when you drink the hot water, your body has to use up a lot of energy to cool it down, and that expends some calories. The second thing is that hot water has the effect of mobilizing toxins. Even while the hot temperature is coming to body temperature, it has the effect of mobilizing toxins, the toxins from your body. When you wash your hands, what does a better job, hot water or cold water? Hot water always works better to get rid of the dirt. Same thing inside. Also, for anyone who wants to detox, it's a good idea to fill up a thermos of boiling hot water and every half an hour drink about a few sips, about maybe a quarter of a cup, few sips. But the frequency is even more important than the amount that you drink. And look at your tongue in the mirror during the day. And you'll find that as your toxins begin to get mobilized from your system, that your tongue will get muddy and coated, and that your breath will start to feel not very fresh. In fact, may have a certain odor to it. As you continue to drink the hot water, within 24 hours or so, you'll find that the tongue will become moist and pink, and the breath will feel fresh. And according to Ayurveda, that's probably the best signal of whether there are toxins in your body or not. Look at your tongue and see if it's moist and pink. And if your breath feels fresh, then that's a very good sign that there aren't any toxins in your body. If your tongue is muddy, coated, and your breath feels stale, then there are toxins in the body. And one of the best ways for mobilizing toxins is to drink copious amounts of hot water, preferably with a little ginger or lemon. And most of our patients, no matter what disease they have, since we believe in this theory of getting rid of toxins, but particularly if they have cancer or degenerative disorders like arthritis or a chronic infection, one of the first things we tell them to do is drink large amounts of hot water with a little ginger or a little lemon. The frequency is important. And to our amazement, absolutely to our amazement, you know, if they're having joint pains, or they're having chronic fatigue, or they're having migraine headaches, or they're having muscle aches and pains, within a few days, it's all gone. It's the most amazing thing, and it fits in with this Ayurvedic theory, which says that whenever we have any chronic illness of any kind, there is accumulation of toxins in the body. And these toxins are referred to in Sanskrit as ama. It's spelled A-M-A, no pun intended. Okay. And as the toxins are removed and you feel fresher, then ama is replaced by something called ojas. Ojas is the opposite of a toxin. It's the elixir of life. For now, I think it's just important to recognize that free radicals and ama probably are the same thing, that antioxidants are a good idea, that massage helps, that drinking large amounts of hot water also mobilizes toxins. What is reality? And perhaps what we call everyday reality is nothing other than a socially programmed hypnosis in which we're all collectively caught up. What we call everyday reality is a socially programmed hypnosis. And from time to time, people have broken out of that socially programmed hypnosis. It's been a motley collection of sages and psychotics and geniuses. Sometimes go to a psychiatric ward, as I've done through my training. Go to a psychiatric ward, and I'm not joking, and you'll see very different expressions of biological age depending on the kind of psychosis that people have. Because psychosis is a reality. It just happens to be an isolated reality and not part of the collective reality. If we are all having a collective psychosis, then we assume it's reality. It happened in Germany when the Holocaust took place. A whole collective psyche became psychotic, but nobody thought, at least while in it, that there was anything abnormal about it. So there's an interesting thing about these altered states of consciousness. In medical school, when we learned about neurosis, we were told a neurotic is a person who builds castles in the air, and a psychotic is one who lives in them. And maybe, it's an important thing to ask ourselves, are we part of a psychosis of the collective mind? That what we call normal is the psychopathology of the average, which we take for granted? It's really, unless we ask ourselves that, we will not be breaking out of the hypnosis of our own conditioning. And that's the whole goal of everything you've learned this week, is to start a process of self-awareness which allows us to become independent of the collective mind, and ultimately to reach a critical mass of self-awareness so the collective mind itself transforms. Because unless the collective mind transforms, our individual thoughts being context-bound, we are not going to really have a change, a real dramatic change in our biological function. Because we are influenced by that. And Ayurveda, in fact, in Vedic science, the history of humanity is divided into four distinct yugas or eons of time. And there are some references to that in the biblical literature as well. So a span of time where the critical mass is more or less enlightened. And if the critical mass is more or less enlightened, then everybody is living for 1,000 years. It's called Satyug in Vedic literature. And the extreme opposite of that is where the critical mass is in the stage of extreme ignorance. And it's presumably what we're in now. And where the average lifespan is less than 100. And then there are phases in between. And the pendulum kind of swings between one eon of time, another eon of time. And there are references to that in biblical literature as well. From a purely scientific perspective, though, I think one can say that our consciousness, because it transforms itself into our biology, is the critical element in the human aging process. Now, having said that, let's go over these biomarkers. I mentioned to you Ellen Langer's study. Well, there was another study in the 1980s, which was not a psychological intervention at all. And this study was from Tufts University. And this study actually took people between the ages of 84 and 96. So the youngest person in the Tufts University study was 84, and the oldest was 96. They started with 84-year-old people, 84 years young people, I should say, and they started with weight training slowly, and then introduced aerobic exercise. And in 6 months of first very gradual progressive increase in exercise, physical exercise, both aerobics and weight training,
In 6 months, these people between the ages of 84 and 96, they were biologically, as measured by these biomarkers, in their 50s and 60s. They could lift more weight, they had more stamina, they had more mental alertness, they had more creativity, they had more vitality, they had more enthusiasm for life than people in their 50s and 60s. Remarkable study, absolutely. So since then, of course, there's the Cooper Institute in the South, and there's the Tufts University group. There are many studies going on now on how far can you carry this. I mean, if you start earlier, would it have more dramatic effects? Intuitively, it makes sense. Physical activity, both weight training, and what weight training does is it increases your basal metabolic rate, it increases your aerobic capacity. These are direct effects of exercise and weight training. It increases bone density, it increases muscle mass, it increases strength of muscle, so there are direct effects of all of this, and it increases DHEA levels as well by itself. So that was another very remarkable piece of data. The third piece of data came also in the 1980s, and this was on a group of people practicing meditation. It was done by Keith Wallace, who is a PhD, and in fact did the first study on the physiology of meditation in 1970. He was associated and has been associated with Maharishi, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who brought meditation to the West, literally in a huge way, starting in the 60s. So Keith Wallace and Benson, who is a Harvard physician, did this landmark study in 1970, which was published in the journal Science. And it was on the physiology of meditation, and where he described meditation as a state of restful alertness, so restful awareness. But subsequently, they did a study where they took meditators, people who had been practicing meditation twice a day regularly for 5 years, and compared them with people in the control population who were not meditating. And at 5 years, the difference in biological age in the same chronological group was 12 years. So people who had been meditating regularly for 5 years had a biological age 12 years younger than their chronological age. You say, how is that possible? Well, that is possible because of all the metabolic effects of the meditative process, and particularly the metabolic effect on hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, prolactin, growth hormone. All these hormones are influenced by meditation. In the mid-80s, I got involved in a study with Dr. Glaser, who used to be a colleague of mine. And what we did, we started measuring DHEA levels in people who regularly practice meditation. DHEA is the adrenal steroid. That's the precursor of the male and female hormones. And we followed people for 5 years, regular meditation. We found that with every year there was an incremental increase in DHEA in the people who were meditating, and there was a corresponding decrease in people who were not. So meditation directly affects DHEA levels in your body, DHEA being an anti-aging hormone. There are other studies that show that growth hormone and growth factors really influence how people age. So in youth, when we are children, we have huge spurts of growth hormone. It's the hormone that's responsible for growth. But adults also secrete growth hormone. And in adults, the function of growth hormone is that it's an anabolic hormone. It takes all forms of energy and stores them in your system. And as people grow older, first of all, the surges of growth hormone decrease, but also growth hormone levels also decrease. So about 1985 or so, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this study was about people all in their 80s
who were actually given growth hormone injections, human growth hormone, which is now easily available and can be synthesized through biotechnology. So these people were all given growth hormone injections for a period of about 6 months. And the New England Journal of Medicine was a leading article on the biological reversibility of the human aging process with the administration of growth hormone. And lots of things were measured, including in this case wrinkles. They had these pictures of people who were in the 80s, and then you look at them and they look like they're 40 or 50, and they keep getting the growth hormone injection and their face keeps changing. And so this became a very controversial study, because obviously people wanted to start using growth hormone, and the FDA had its own precautions about this because not much was known. And surely, as these people continued to receive growth hormone, they developed other problems. Acromegaly, which is an endocrine problem, they developed diabetes, they developed congestive heart failure, something called cardiomyopathy, which is a condition of the heart, they even had an increased incidence of cancer. So growth hormone therapy for its anti-aging effects was discarded in the United States. But if you are from Europe, then I can tell you that there are clinics today in Switzerland and in parts of France where people still go for growth hormone rejuvenative therapy. And it's given under controlled conditions. What's my opinion about that? I think it's highly dangerous. You can probably never predict what's going to happen if you give an excessive amount of growth hormone, and it's going to probably create monsters in the future if it is continued. But because of this data, we also got interested, and my colleagues and some of us who are interested in this started measuring growth factors and growth hormone after massage. And of course, growth hormone goes up very dramatically after a massage, in adults as well as in children. In children, of course, also it grows up. If you massage a baby every day, it'll grow twice as fast, given the same diet in the early formative years. Same diet, because of the secretion of growth factors and growth hormone. So I think massage has rejuvenative effects, undoubtedly, not only because of the secretion of growth hormone, but also because of the absorption of free radical scavengers, and especially if you use antioxidants in the massage oil, if you use herbal supplements in the massage oil, there's a huge amount of transdermal absorption which affects not only growth hormone levels but the antioxidant effects. So therefore, there's another strategy to aging, anti-aging, and that is nutritional supplements. What are the nutritional supplements that definitely alter biological markers of aging? Antioxidants. The research is on antioxidants. So vitamin C, A, E are antioxidants. And they definitely affect the biomarkers of aging. Now, we started to look at the herbal supplements in the Vedic, Ayurvedic literature. And of all of those, the one that's supposed to be the most effective is Amlaki, the Indian gooseberry, Embelia myrabolum. This is the most powerful antioxidant known, more than any vitamin C that you can take, because it comes in a very special way, packaged by Mother Nature. The receptors in the body recognize it, and the way it's made is with ghee, which is clarified butter. And you would say, my God, clarified butter, what's that going to do to my cholesterol? Well, first of all, there's very little of it. Secondly, it turns out that our receptors that bind to these antioxidants in the body are lipid receptors, which means they're made of little molecules of fat. So actually, the clarified butter, which is used to prepare this biochavan, it helps the absorption of this nutrient. There are many good studies worldwide on the effects of this antioxidant effect, anti-carcinogenic effects, anti-arthritic effects, and basically rejuvenative effects. So if I was to summarize all the strategies for aging, I would say they are as follows, the ones that I mentioned. change your expectation about aging, get enough exercise to really make a difference in your muscle mass, in your muscle strength, in your bone density. And you have to go about doing that gradually, but really put attention on increasing muscle mass, bone density, and muscle strength. Everything else will be taken care of if you do that. Third, meditate every day, regularly, consistently. Once a day is not good enough. It's like, you know, taking one aspirin, it doesn't get rid of the headache. You have to take two. And you don't need to take three, you might get an ulcer. So you don't need to meditate more than twice a day also, you don't want to feel like a zombie. Just the right dose. And fourth, take nutritional supplements, either herbal or other antioxidants.
Spiritual bonding means bonding with the essence in others, the essence in all life forms, which is the same as the essence in me. There's a traditional greeting in India, Namaste, when people fold their hands and say Namaste. That literally means, I salute and pay homage to that place inside of you, which is the same as that place inside of me. Spiritual bonding really is the ultimate in intimacy, to be able to see every life form in its true essence. And when I do that, then I see myself reflected in everything that I see, that everything I experience is nothing but an expression of myself. And intimacy is such an important issue that I would now like to extend it to the sense that everyone is your equal. The world is my family is a familiar saying in India. This feeling of community, whether it begins with family and neighbors or spreads to embrace people across the seas, gives rise to the state of spiritual bonding. If I see a starving child in Africa, I feel his suffering. Even though we do not share the same nervous system, nevertheless, my feeling makes us one, if only for a moment. Much more happens than just a twinge of emotion. A channel of communication has been opened up. A shared awareness begins to take the place of single, isolated awareness. Our collective future on this planet depends upon opening up such channels of compassion, acceptance, and understanding for others. At the individual level, this requires opening ourselves beyond the confines of the little space we occupy. These little spaces are an illusion, preventing each of us from seeing ourselves as expanded beings. It is just this delicate feeling of being close enough to share awareness with someone else that helps the whole illusion of isolation and separateness to ultimately get shattered. At the outset, the notion of spiritual bonding may seem foreign, since it goes so far beyond emotional bonding, which is what we ordinarily mean by love. To love someone opens up a flow of emotion that dissolves all barriers. When the beloved is happy, you are happy. When the beloved is sad, your heart is filled with the same sadness. But spiritual bonding is not dependent upon this sort of emotional fusion. Even though you are sharing your whole self with another, including the other in yourself, there is no loss of individuality. It seems like a paradox. Giving your heart away to a beloved can entail a kind of loss. You are giving up sole ownership of your emotions, and in return, the beloved does not have to be fair or kind or generous. The risk is that you will be taken advantage of in your state of extreme vulnerability. If what you have to give away is your whole self, however, nothing can be lost. Because your whole self is everything, as is the other person you are relating to. Giving everything to everything leaves everything behind. So bonding at the level of the self is extremely secure. It rests upon the realization that who you are is far more than any fear you might have. The inability to be intimate comes down to the belief that fear of rejection is greater than yourself. When you see that this belief is a mistake, that you are much greater than your fears, other people can become as intimate as yourself. Since you do not fear yourself, there is no room for fear of others either. The first question is whether this sort of complete intimacy can really be attained. In our society, the whole notion of uniting with another arouses images of surrender, submission, losing one's identity, becoming a pawn to another's ego. In India, the Vedic texts say that a person returning to the higher self is like a raindrop returning to melt back into the sea. This image holds considerable threat to the ego, which has no intention of melting back into anything greater than itself, which has a hard time even conceding that anything greater than itself can exist. To diffuse this threat, one must be reassured that nothing is lost in rejoining the totality of life. Life grows according to certain laws of nature, and as long as we remain within the security of those laws, growth is effortless, natural, and painless. The Vedic sages knew very well that the image of a drop melting into the ocean created fear. As the raindrop falls from heaven, they said, it is afraid of being lost in the stream. As one stream merges into another, it is afraid of being lost in the river. As the river flows faster downhill, it is afraid of merging into the sea. But the process is inevitable, and when the river finally does merge, the raindrop discovers to its great surprise that nothing has been lost. It remains a drop while yet becoming the sea. With this realization comes supreme joy. Once you know that your identity is not going to be sacrificed for the benefit of the whole, being the whole sounds absolutely ideal. Who would remain a drop if he could have the unbounded status of the ocean? Our society is so fixated on individuality at any price that it has taught us practically nothing about the joy of merging into the totality of pure awareness. I can recall one beautiful instance when the renowned Jewish philosopher Martin Buber chanced to spot a shiny rock by the side of the road. He writes, "On a gloomy morning, I walked upon the highway, saw a piece of mica, lifted it up, and looked at it for a long time. And the day was no longer gloomy. So much light was caught in the stone. And suddenly, as I raised my eyes from it, I realized that while I looked, I had not been conscious of object and subject. In my looking, the mica and I had been one. In my looking, I had tasted unity. I looked at it again. The unity did not remain." This is not a mystical moment. It is just true experience, stripped of the veils that make us think we are not one with the rocks, trees, mountains, and stars. For a brief moment, Buber had replaced duality with unity, catching on the wing a vision of the world that could be captured permanently. That rarely happens because the nervous system of ordinary people is too active, too dulled by years of conditioning. Even so, everyone has moments, lying under the open sky, when the presence of vastness announces itself. When the merging of oneself into nature is the easiest, most spontaneous of feelings. A poignant expression of this came to me from a patient with advanced breast cancer. To regain her perspective, after a long trial with chemotherapy, she wrote down certain personal experiences from her past that had shaped her most profoundly. One of these occurred when she was a girl of 16. She entitled it, "But how can I be the moon?" She wrote, "Lying alone in the pasture, dark except for the magnetic full moon. There's an overwhelming sense of quietness. My being is part of the earth and part of the pure white light of the moon at the same time. Nothing else is significant. For a second I wonder, am I dead? It isn't important. I'm spending an hour in God's hands, and it will become part of me. A surprising number of people have had such experiences, in which a spiritual closeness to the earth cleanses them of everyday troubles and limitations. As she grew old, my patient slipped away from this experience, gradually becoming used to the grind of work and the family worries that disconnect all of us from nature. In her case, the accumulated stress led to frequent sickness. She wryly titles her later life, "Going Against Nature." This is adulthood. At a certain point, she had a re-encounter in which the old feeling of contact came back with undiminished freshness. In her mid-twenties, she visited the Pacific shore and wrote this passage. For about 2 hours on the beach alone, I was with God again. I was the surf, its sound and strength. I was the sand, warm, vibrating, alive. I was the breeze, soft and free. I was the sky, endless and pure. I felt only great love. I was more than my body and knew it. This moment was absolutely cleansing and beautiful. What she expresses, I also believe as a doctor. The healing mechanism inside us perfectly matches the one outside. The human body does not look like a green meadow or a beach by the Pacific. Yet the same breezes, the laughing water, sunlight and earth have only been transformed into us, not forgotten. Because the body is intelligent, it knows of its complete bonding with nature. And when it returns home to nature, it feels free, unbounded. With overflowing joy, it recognizes its mother, the great being who bathed us for millions of years in its oceans and nurtured our primordial cells with sun and air. To be one with her again is vital. It allows inner and outer to blend, healing a separation that never existed to begin with. Everything that happens in the universe affects us. We are part of a huge cosmic web, and if any part of the web is affected, then every strand changes. Similarly, any fluctuation in any strand of the cosmic web will have an effect on the web as a whole. So there's an expression in physics, when an electron vibrates, the universe shakes. This is because we are inseparably connected as patterns of intelligence with everything else. And the more intimately we are connected, the more wholeness we experience, the more healthy we will be. Spiritual bonding really ultimately creates balance not only in ourselves, but in nature as a whole. As with all spiritual realizations, this one of spiritual bonding cannot be forced. It cannot be adopted secondhand. And yet there is nothing especially grandiose about it. For instance, the movement to clean up the environment, which millions of people are participating in, has behind it the urge to become one with all life. In trying to heal the ecology, we are beginning to feel that this whole world, most of which we never personally experience, is intimately connected to us. Of course, it is also true that ecological concerns are often based on fear and panic, the ego dread that worries whether I will have enough gasoline, enough bread, enough electricity, etc. In the past, humanity treated the planet the way many people treat a rental apartment. Live in it for a while, trash it, and move on. But once you sense that Mother Earth is alive and that she has shared her life with us who are her children, you cannot help but feel diminished by an oil slick fouling the ocean, by a porpoise dying in agony in a fishing net, or a scorched stretch of barrenness where once a rainforest stood. Feeling personally hurt when the earth is wounded is a sign of intimacy. But so is the joy you feel when the migrating geese fly so gracefully across the face of the sky and oak trees burst into a rapture of green leaves in spring. Intimacy with the environment, with other countries, with the entire planet are all possible. It is natural for your sense of self to constantly expand, and intimacy will never stop growing until it becomes all-inclusive. There is no need for fear, because far from abandoning yourself, you will keep regaining yourself on a wider and wider scale. The same honest self-acceptance remains at work through all stages of intimacy, whether you honestly say to someone else, "I need your love, please forgive me," or utter the same words to your Mother Earth. Only guilty, insecure people have to hold power over others. The same is true for people who carelessly spoil the environment. When intimacy is allowed to grow, reverence for life blossoms on its own. I have said that there is nothing to lose when you completely share yourself. But what is the purpose of this sharing? The purpose changes as one passes through different levels of awareness. At one stage, you may want to solve the problem of your own loneliness or gain self-esteem. At another stage, you may want to heal others or to support your community, to be more caring and to be more open. What remains the same, however, is the desire to know more about yourself. You are always dealing with your own connection to your own inner world. Whatever takes place outside is merely a reflection of the shifting aspects you see inside, the changing needs that signal where your spirit wants to go from moment to moment. By establishing bonds of intimacy, we basically display an open curiosity about ourselves and a willingness to be real. One time, a student was sitting with his teacher, discussing the horrors of war and lamenting the violence that nations never seem to abandon. "Don't look at that violence as if it is outside yourself," the teacher cautioned. Taken aback, the student replied, "But I am not violent. I treat everyone kindly. I can't remember the last time I raised my voice." The teacher interrupted him. "Would you concede that there is at least a spark of anger left inside you?" he asked. "Of course," the student admitted. "Doesn't everyone have something like that inside?" The teacher nodded. "You see, it is that spark of anger, that unexamined bit of violence, which each person contributes to war. Small as it seems, your inner anger is the cause of war. The fact that it appears tiny to you does not make it any different, for at the deepest level of consciousness, the rules of large and small do not apply. A spark is enough to burn down an entire forest." It is these small pockets of anger, resentment, insecurity, worthlessness, and fear that we bring to light in intimate relationship. Although the whole process of self-discovery takes place internally, relationships serve an invaluable purpose by keeping us honest, by indicating where we need to grow, by repeatedly proving that we will be accepted, by increasing our sense that being real will bring us love and approval. These are the purposes of spiritual bonding. Relationships will never rise to their full importance until they begin to serve self-awareness. They certainly can serve other worthwhile purposes. We turn to friends and family for advice and sympathy. We look to them for support in hard times. They afford us company when we feel alone or abandoned. Yet the highest purpose of any relationship is to reveal the self to itself. When you feel doubtful about a certain relationship that seems to have grown stale and unsatisfying, what has happened is that you are no longer growing. The sense of being trapped or too involved or suffocated by someone else is a signal that the lines of communication have broken down in your relationship. Communication is all important because at the deepest level, every message being sent to you is from your own self. So whenever you get a certain response from the environment, the thing is not to look at the environment. The thing is to look at yourself and see, what message am I sending out here? What energy signal am I sending out here? So if you want to improve your relationship, you ultimately just have to improve your relationship with yourself. Be truthful with yourself. Have insight into why you sent out that signal. And then spontaneously, as you change, the world around you will change.